a strange guy. She might even be deluded into thinking that he trusted her. That he knew about her propensities as a hacker was serious. Salander was aware that the legal description of the kind of hacking she did, both professionally and as a hobby, was unlawful data trespassing, and could earn her 2 years in prison. She did not want to be locked up. In her case, a prison sentence would mean that her computers would be taken from her, and with them the only occupation that she was really good at. She had never told Armansky how she gathered the information they were paying her to find. With the exception of Plague and a few people on the net who, like her, devoted themselves to hacking on a professional level, and most of them knew her only as Wasp and did not know who she was or where she lived, Kalle Blomqvist was the only one who had stumbled onto her secret. He had come to her because she made a blunder that not even a 12-year-old would commit, which only proved that her brain was being eaten up by worms and that she deserved to be flogged. But instead of going crazy with rage, he had hired her. Consequently, she was mildly irritated with him. When they had a snack just before she went to bed, he had suddenly asked her if she was a good hacker. To her own surprise, she replied, "I'm probably the best in Sweden. There may be two or three others at about my level." She did not doubt the accuracy of her reply. Plague had once been better than she was, but she had passed him long ago. On the other hand, it felt funny to say the words. She had never done it before. She had never had an outsider to have this sort of conversation with, and she enjoyed the fact that he seemed impressed by her talents. Then he had ruined the feeling by asking another question. How had she taught herself hacking? What could she say? "I've always been able to do it." Instead, she went to bed without saying good night. Irritating her yet further, he did not react when she left so abruptly. She lay listening to him moving about in the kitchen, clearing the table and washing the dishes. He had always stayed up later than she did, but now he was obviously on his way to bed too. She heard him in the bathroom, and then he went into his bedroom and shut the door. After a while she heard the bed creak when he got into it, not a yard away from her own, but on the other side of the wall. She had been sharing a house with him for a week, and he had not once flirted with her. He had worked with her, asked her opinion, slapped her on the knuckles, figuratively speaking, when she was on the wrong track, and acknowledged that she was right when she corrected him. Damn it, he had treated her like a human being. She got out of bed and stood by the window, restlessly peering into the dark. The hardest thing for her was to show herself naked to another person for the first time. She was convinced that her skinny body was repulsive. Her breasts were pathetic. She had no hips to speak of. She did not have much to offer. Apart from that, she was quite a normal woman, with the same desires and sex drive as every other woman. She stood there for the next 20 minutes before she made up her mind. Blomqvist was reading a novel by Sarah Paretsky when he heard the door handle turn and looked up to see Salander. She had a sheet wrapped round her body and stood in the doorway for a moment. "You okay?" he said. She shook her head. "What is it?" She went over to his bed, took the book and put it on the bedside table, then she bent down and kissed him on the mouth. She quickly got into his bed and sat, looking at him, searching him. She put her hand on the sheet over his stomach. When he did not protest, she leaned over and bit him on the nipple. Blomqvist was flabbergasted. He took her shoulders and pushed her away a little so that he could see her face. "Lisbeth, I don't know if this is such a good idea. We have to work together."
"I want to have sex with you, and I won't have any problem working with you, but I will have a hell of a problem with you if you kick me out."
"But we hardly know each other." She laughed, an abrupt laugh that sounded almost like a cough.
"You've never let anything like that stand in your way before. In fact, as I didn't say in my background report, you're one of these guys who can't keep his hands off women. So what's wrong? Aren't I sexy enough for you?"
Blomqvist shook his head and tried to think of something clever to say. When he couldn't, she pulled the sheet off him and sat astride him. "I don't have any condoms," he said.
"Screw it."
When he woke up, he heard her in the kitchen. It was not yet 7. He may only have slept for 2 hours, and he stayed in bed, dozing. This woman baffled him. At absolutely no point had she even with a glance indicated that she was the least bit interested in him. "Good morning," she said from the doorway. She even had the hint of a smile. "Hi.
We are out of milk. I'll go to the petrol station. They open at 7.
And she was gone. He heard her go out of the front door. He shut his eyes. Then he heard the front door open again, and seconds later she was back in the doorway. This time she was not smiling.
"You'd better come and look at this," she said in a strange voice.
Blomqvist was on his feet at once and pulled on his jeans. During the night, someone had been to the cottage with an unwelcome present. On the porch lay the half-charred corpse of a cat. The cat's legs and head had been cut off. Then the body had been flayed and the guts and stomach removed, flung next to the corpse, which seemed to have been roasted over a fire. The cat's head was intact, on the saddle of Salander's motorcycle. He recognized the reddish-brown fur. Chapter 22. Thursday, July 10th. They ate breakfast in the garden in silence and without milk in their coffee. Salander had taken out a Canon digital camera and photographed the macabre tableau before Blomqvist got a rubbish sack and cleaned it away. He put the cat in the boot of the Volvo. He ought to file a police report for animal cruelty, possibly intimidation, but he did not think he would want to explain why the intimidation had taken place. At 8:30, Isabella Wanger walked past and onto the bridge. She did not see them, or at least pretended not to.
"How are you doing?" Blomqvist said.
"Oh, I'm fine."
Salander looked at him, perplexed.
"Okay, then. He expects me to be upset. When I find the motherfucker who tortured an innocent cat to death just to send us a warning, I'm going to clobber him with a baseball bat."
"You think it's a warning?"
"Have you got a better explanation? It definitely means something."
"Whatever the truth is in this story, we've worried somebody enough for that person to do something really sick. But there's another problem, too."
"I know. This is an animal sacrifice in the style of 1954 and 1960, and it doesn't seem credible that someone active 50 years ago would be putting tortured animal corpses on your doorstep today."
Blomqvist agreed.
"The only ones who could be suspected in that case are Harold Wanger and Isabella Wanger. There are a number of older relatives on Johann Wanger's side, but none of them live in the area."
Blomqvist sighed. "Isabella is a repulsive bitch who could certainly kill a cat, but I doubt she was running around killing women in the 50s. Harold Wanger, I don't know. He seems so decrepit he can hardly walk, and I can't see him sneaking over here last night catching a cat and doing all this."
"Unless it was 2 people. One older, one younger."
Blomqvist heard a car go by and looked up and saw Cecilia driving away over the bridge. Harold and Cecilia, he thought. But they hardly spoke. Despite Martin Wanger's promise to talk to her, Cecilia had still not answered any of his telephone messages.
"It must be somebody who knows we're doing this work and that we're making progress,"
Salander said, getting up to go inside. When she came back out, she had put on her leathers.
"I'm going to Stockholm. I'll be back tonight."
"What are you going to do?"
"Pick up some gadgets. If someone is crazy enough to kill a cat in that disgusting way, he or she could attack us next time. Or set the cottage on fire while we're asleep. I want you to go into Hedderstad and buy 2 fire extinguishers and 2 smoke alarms today. One of the fire extinguishers has to be Halon."
Without another word, she put on her helmet, kick-started the motorcycle, and roared off across the bridge. Blomqvist hid the corpse and the head and guts in the rubbish bin beside the petrol station before he drove into Hedderstad to do his errands. He drove to the hospital. He had made an appointment to meet Frode in the cafeteria, and he told him what had happened that morning. Frode blanched.
"Mikael, I never imagined that this story could take this turn."
"Why not? The job was to find a murderer, after all."
"But this is disgusting and inhuman. If there's a danger to your life, or to Fröken Salander's life, we are going to call it off. Let me talk to Henrik."
"No, absolutely not. I don't want to risk his having another attack."
"He asks me all the time, how things are going with you.
Say hello for me, please, and tell him I'm moving forward.
What is next, then?
I have a few questions. The first incident occurred just after Henrik had his heart attack and I was down in Stockholm for the day. Somebody went through my office. I had printed out the Bible verses and the photographs from Järnvägsgatan were on my desk. You knew and Henrik knew. Martin knew a part of it since he organized for me to get into the courier offices. How many other people knew?
Well, I don't know who Martin talked to, but both Birger and Cecilia knew about it. They discussed your hunting in the pictures archive between themselves. Alexander knew about it, too. And, by the way, Gunnar and Helen and Nielsen did, too. They were up to say hello to Henrik and got dragged into the conversation. And Anita Wanger.
Anita? The one in London?
Cecilia's sister. She came back with Cecilia when Henrik had his heart attack, but stayed at a hotel. As far as I know, she hasn't been out to the island. Like Cecilia, she doesn't want to see her father. But she flew back when Henrik came out of intensive care.
Where's Cecilia living?
I saw her this morning as she drove across the bridge, but her house is always dark. She's not capable of doing such a thing, is she?
No. I just wonder where she's staying.
She's staying with her brother Birger. It's within walking distance to visit Henrik.
Do you know where she is right now?
No. She's not visiting Henrik, at any rate.
Thanks, Blomqvist said, getting up.
The Wanger family was hovering around Hedestad Hospital. In the reception, Birger Wanger passed on his way to the lifts. Blomqvist waited until he was gone before he went out to the reception. Instead, he ran into Martin Wanger at the entrance, at exactly the same spot where he had run into Cecilia on his previous visit. They said hello and shook hands.
"Have you been up to see Henrik?"
"No, I just happened to meet Dirk Frode."
Martin looked tired and hollow-eyed. It occurred to Mikael that he had aged appreciably during the 6 months since he had met him.
"How are things going with you, Mikael?"
he said.
"More interesting with every day that passes. When Henrik is feeling better, I hope to be able to satisfy his curiosity."
Birger Wanger's was a white brick terrace house a 5-minute walk from the hospital. He had a view of the sea and the Hedestad Marina. No one answered when Blomqvist rang the doorbell. He called Cecilia's mobile number, but got no answer there, either. He sat in the car for a while, drumming his fingers on the steering wheel. Birger Wanger was the wild card in the deck, born in 1939 and so 10 years old when Rebecca Jacobson was murdered, 27 when Harriet disappeared. According to Henrik, Birger and Harriet hardly ever saw each other. He had grown up with his family in Uppsala and only moved to Hedestad to work for the firm. He jumped ship after a couple of years and devoted himself to politics, but he had been in Uppsala at the time Lena Andersson was murdered. The incident with the cat gave him an ominous feeling, as if he were about to run out of time. Otto Falk was 36 when Harriet vanished. He was now 72, younger than Henrik Wanger, but in a considerably worse mental state. Blomqvist sought him out at the Svalen Convalescent Home, a yellow brick building a short distance from the Heide River at the other end of the town. Blomqvist introduced himself to the receptionist and asked to be allowed to speak with Pastor Falk. He knew, he explained, that the pastor suffered from Alzheimer's and inquired how lucid he was now. A nurse replied that Pastor Falk had first been diagnosed 3 years earlier, and that, alas, the disease had taken an aggressive course. Falk could communicate, but he had a very feeble short-term memory, and did not recognize all of his relatives. He was on the whole slipping into the shadows. He was also prone to anxiety attacks if he was confronted with questions he could not answer. Falk was sitting on a bench in the garden with 3 other patients and a male nurse. Blomqvist spent an hour trying to engage him in conversation. He remembered Harriet Wanger quite well. His face lit up, and he described her as a charming girl. But Blomqvist was soon aware that the pastor had forgotten that she had been missing these last 37 years. He talked about her as if he had seen her recently, and asked Blomqvist to say hello to her, and urge her to come and see him. Blomqvist promised to do so. He obviously did not remember the accident on the bridge. It was not until the end of their conversation that he said something which made Blomqvist prick up his ears. It was when Blomqvist steered the talk to Harriet's interest in religion that Falk suddenly seemed hesitant. It was as though a cloud passed over his face. Falk sat rocking back and forth for a while and then looked up at Blomqvist and asked who he was. Blomqvist introduced himself again, and the old man thought for a while. At length he said,
"She's still a seeker. She has to take care of herself, and you have to warn her."
"What should I warn her about?"
Falk grew suddenly agitated. He shook his head with a frown.
"She has to read Sola Scriptura and understand Sufficientia Scripturi. That's the only way that she can maintain sola fide. Joseph will certainly exclude them. They were never accepted into the canon."
Blomqvist understood nothing of this, but took assiduous notes. Then Pastor Falk leaned towards him and whispered,
"I think she's a Catholic. She loves magic and has not yet found her God. She needs guidance."
The word Catholic obviously had a negative connotation for Pastor Falk. "I thought she was interested in the Pentecostal movement."
"No, no, no, not the Pentecostals. She's looking for the forbidden truth. She is not a good Christian."
Then Pastor Falk seemed to forget all about Blomqvist and started talking with the other patients. He got back to Hedeby Island just after 2. He walked over to Cecilia Vanger's and knocked on the door, but without success. He tried her mobile number again, but no answer. He attached one smoke alarm to a wall in the kitchen and one next to the front door. He put one fire extinguisher next to the wood stove beside the bedroom door and another one beside the bathroom door. Then he made himself lunch, which consisted of coffee and open sandwiches, and sat in the garden where he was typing up the notes of his conversation with Pastor Falk. When that was done, he raised his eyes to the church. Hedeby's new parsonage was quite an ordinary, modern dwelling a few minutes' walk from the church. Blomqvist knocked on the door at 4 and explained to Pastor Margareta Strand that he had come to seek advice on a theological matter. Margareta Strand was a dark-haired woman of about his own age, dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt. She was barefoot and had painted toenails. He had run into her before at Suzanne's Bridge Café on a couple of occasions and talked to her about Pastor Falk. He was given a friendly reception and invited to come and sit in her courtyard. Blomqvist told her that he had interviewed Otto Falk and what the old man had said. Pastor Strand listened and then asked him to repeat it, word for word. "I was sent to serve here in Hedeby only 3 years ago, and I've never actually met Pastor Falk. He retired several years before that, but I believe that he was fairly high church. What he said to you meant something on the lines of, 'Keep to Scripture alone, sola scriptura,' and that it is sufficientia scripturi. This latter is an expression that establishes the sufficiency of Scripture among literal believers. Sola fide means faith alone, or the true faith."
"I see."
"All this is basic dogma, so to speak. In general, it's the platform of the church and nothing unusual at all. He was saying quite simply, read the Bible, it will provide sufficient knowledge and vouches for the true faith." Mikhail felt a bit embarrassed. "Now, I have to ask you in what connection this conversation occurred," she said.
"I was asking him about a person he had met many years ago, someone I'm writing about."
"A religious seeker?"
"Something along that line."
"Okay, I think I understand the context. You told me that Pastor Falk said 2 other things, that Joseph will certainly exclude them, and that they were never accepted into the canon. Is it possible that you misunderstood and that he said Josephus instead of Joseph? It's actually the same name."
"That's possible," Blomqvist said. "I taped the conversation if you want to listen to it."
"No, I don't think that's necessary. These 2 sentences establish fairly unequivocally what he was alluding to. Josephus was a Jewish historian, and the sentence, 'they were never accepted into the canon,' may have meant that they were never in the Hebrew canon."
"And that means?" She laughed.
"Pastor Falk was saying that this person was enthralled by the esoteric sources, specifically the Apocrypha. The Greek word apokryphos means hidden, and the Apocrypha are therefore the hidden books which some consider highly controversial and others think should be included in the Old Testament. They are Tobias, Judith, Esther, Baruch, Sirach, and the books of the Maccabees, and some others."
"Forgive my ignorance. I've heard about the books of the Apocrypha, but have never read them. What's special about them?"
There's really nothing special about them at all, except that they came into existence somewhat later than the rest of the Old Testament. The Apocrypha were deleted from the Hebrew Bible, not because Jewish scholars mistrusted their content, but simply because they were written after the time when God's revelatory work was concluded. On the other hand, the Apocrypha are included in the Old Greek translation of the Bible. They're not considered controversial in, for example, the Roman Catholic Church.
I see.
However, they are controversial in the Protestant Church. During the Reformation, theologians looked to the old Hebrew Bible. Martin Luther deleted the Apocrypha from the Reformation's Bible, and later Calvin declared that the Apocrypha absolutely must not serve as the basis for convictions in matters of faith. Thus, their contents contradict, or in some way conflict with claritas scripturi, the clarity of scripture.
In other words, censored books.
Quite right. For example, the Apocrypha claim that magic can be practiced, and that lies in certain cases may be permissible, and such statements, of course, upset dogmatic interpreters of scripture.
So if someone has a passion for religion, it's not unthinkable that the Apocrypha will pop up on their reading list. Or that someone like Pastor Falk would be upset by this.
Exactly. Encountering the Apocrypha is almost unavoidable if you're studying the Bible or the Catholic faith, and it's equally probable that someone who is interested in esoterica in general might read them.
You don't happen to have a copy of the Apocrypha, do you? She laughed again, a bright, friendly laugh.
Of course I do. The Apocrypha were actually published as a state report from the Bible Commission in the 80s.
Armansky wondered what was going on when Salander asked to speak to him in private. He shut the door behind her and motioned her to the visitor's chair. She told him that her work for Mikhail Blomkvist was done. The lawyer would be paying her before the end of the month, but that she had decided to keep on with this particular investigation. Blomkvist had offered her a considerably higher salary for a month.
"I'm self-employed," Salander said. "Until now, I've never taken a job that you haven't given me, in keeping with our agreement. What I want to know is what will happen to our relationship if I take a job on my own."
Armansky shrugged.
"You're a freelancer. You can take any job you want and charge what you think it's worth. I'm just glad you're making your own money. It would, however, be disloyal of you to take on clients you find through us."
"I have no plans to do that. I've finished the job according to the contract we signed with Blomkvist. What this is about is that I want to stay on the case. I'd even do it for nothing."
"Don't ever do anything for nothing."
"You know what I mean. I want to know where this story is going. I've convinced Blomkvist to ask the lawyer to keep me on as a research assistant."
She passed the agreement over to Armansky, who read rapidly through it.
"With this salary, you might as well be working for free. Lisbeth, you've got talent. You don't have to work for small change. You know you can make a hell of a lot more with me if you come on board full-time."
"I don't want to work full-time. But, Dragan, my loyalty is to you. You've been great to me since I started here. I want to know if a contract like this is okay with you, that there won't be any friction between us."
"I see."
He thought for a moment.
"It's 100% okay."
"Thanks for asking.
If any more situations like this crop up in the future, I'd appreciate it if you asked me so there won't be any misunderstandings."
Salander thought over whether she had anything to add. She fixed her gaze on Armansky, saying not a word. Instead, she just nodded and then stood up and left, as usual, with no farewell greeting. She got the answer she wanted and instantly lost interest in Armansky. He smiled to himself. That she had even asked him for advice marked a new high point in her socialization process. He opened a folder with a report on security at a museum where a big exhibition of French Impressionists was opening soon. Then he put down the folder and looked at the door through which Salander had just gone. He thought about how she had laughed with Blomkvist in her office and wondered if she was finally growing up, or whether it was Blomkvist who was the attraction. He also felt a strange uneasiness. He had never been able to shake off the feeling that Lisbeth Salander was a perfect victim. And here she was, hunting a madman out in the back of beyond. On the way north again, Salander took on impulse a detour by way of Epbelviken nursing home to see her mother. Except for the visit on Midsummer Eve, she had not seen her mother since Christmas, and she felt bad for so seldom taking the time. A second visit within the course of a few weeks was quite unusual. Her mother was in the day room. Sallander stayed a good hour and took her mother for a walk down to the duck pond in the grounds of the hospital. Her mother was still muddling Lisbeth with her sister. As usual, she was hardly present, but she seemed troubled by the visit. When Sallander said goodbye, her mother did not want to let go of her hand. Sallander promised to visit her again soon, but her mother gazed after her sadly and anxiously. It was as if she had a premonition of some approaching disaster. Blomqvist spent 2 hours in the garden behind his cabin going through the Apocrypha without gaining a single insight. But a thought had occurred to him. How religious had Harriet Wanger actually been? Her interest in Bible studies had started the last year before she vanished. She had linked a number of Bible quotes to a series of murders, and then had methodically read not only her Bible, but also the Apocrypha. And she had developed an interest in Catholicism. Had she really done the same investigation that Blomqvist and Sallander were doing 37 years later? Was it the hunt for a murderer that had spurred her interest, rather than religiosity? Pastor Falk had indicated that in his eyes she was more of a seeker, less a good Christian. He was interrupted by Berger calling him on his mobile.
"I just wanted to tell you that Gregor and I are leaving on holiday next week. I'll be gone for 4 weeks."
"Where are you going?"
"New York. Gregor has an exhibition, and then we thought we'd go to the Caribbean. We have a chance to borrow a house on Antigua from a friend of Gregor's, and we're staying there 2 weeks."
"That sounds wonderful. Have a great time, and say hi to Gregor."
"The new issue is finished, and we've almost wrapped up the next one. I wish you could take over as editor, but Krista has said he will do it."
"He can call me if he needs any help. How's it going with Jana Dahlman?"
She hesitated.
"He's also going on holiday. I've pushed Henry into being the acting managing editor. He and Krista are minding the store."
"Okay.
I'll be back on August 7th.
In the early evening, Blomqvist tried 5 times to telephone Cecilia Wanger. He sent her a text asking her to call him, but he received no answer. He put away the Apocrypha and got into his tracksuit, locking the door before he set off. He followed the narrow path along the shore and then turned into the woods. He ground his way through thickets and around uprooted trees as fast as he could go, emerging exhausted at the fortress with his pulse racing. He stopped by one of the old artillery batteries and stretched for several minutes. Suddenly he heard a sharp crack, and the grey concrete wall next to his head exploded. Then he felt the pain as fragments of concrete and shrapnel tore a deep gash in his scalp. For what seemed an eternity, Blomqvist stood paralysed. Then he threw himself into the artillery trench, landing hard on his shoulder and knocking the wind out of himself. A second round came at the instant he dived. The bullet smacked into the concrete foundation. He got to his feet and looked all around. He was in the middle of the fortress. To the right and left, narrow, overgrown passages a yard deep ran to the batteries that were spread along a line of 250 yards. In a crouch, he started running south through the labyrinth. He suddenly heard an echo of Captain Adolfsson's inimitable voice from winter manoeuvres at the infantry school in Kiruna.
"Blomqvist, keep your fucking head down if you don't want to get your ass shot off."
Years later, he still remembered the extra practice drills that Captain Adolfsson used to devise. He stopped to catch his breath, his heart pounding. He could hear nothing but his own breathing.
"The human eye perceives motion much quicker than shapes and figures. Move slowly when you're scouting."
Blomqvist slowly peeked an inch over the top edge of the battery. The sun was straight ahead and made it impossible to make out details, but he could see no movement. He pulled his head back down and ran on to the next battery.
"It doesn't matter how good the enemy's weapons are. If he can't see you, he can't hit you. Cover, cover, cover. Make sure you're never exposed."
He was 300 yards from the edge of Ustogorden Farm. Some 40 yards from where he knelt, there was an almost impenetrable thicket of low brush. But to reach the thicket, he would have to sprint down a grass slope from the artillery battery, and he would be completely exposed. It was the only way. At his back was the sea. He was suddenly aware of a pain in his temple and discovered that he was bleeding and that his T-shirt was drenched with blood. "Scalp wounds never stop bleeding," he thought before he again concentrated on his position. One shot could just have been an accident, but 2 meant that somebody was trying to kill him. He had no way of knowing if the marksman was waiting for him to reappear. He tried to be calm, think rationally. The choice was to wait or to get the hell out. If the marksman was still there, the latter alternative was assuredly not a good idea. If he waited where he was, the marksman would calmly walk up to the fortress, find him, and shoot him at close range. He, or she, can't know if I've gone to the right or left. Rifle, maybe a moose rifle, probably with telescopic sights, which would mean that the marksman would have a limited field of vision if he was looking for Mikhail through the sights.
If you're in a tight spot, take the initiative.
Better than waiting. He watched and listened for sounds for 2 minutes, then he clambered out of the battery and raced down the slope as fast as he could. He was halfway down the slope as a third shot was fired, but he only heard a vague smack behind him. He threw himself flat through the curtain of brush and rolled through a sea of stinging nettles. Then he was on his feet and moving away from the direction of the fire, crouching, running, stopping every 50 yards, listening. He heard a branch crack somewhere between him and the fortress. He dropped to his stomach.
"Crawl using your elbows," was another of Captain Adolson's favourite expressions. Blomqvist covered the next 150 yards on his knees and toes and elbows through the undergrowth. He pushed aside twigs and branches. Twice he heard sudden cracks in the thicket behind him. The first seemed to be very close, maybe 20 paces to the right. He froze, lay perfectly still. After a while he cautiously raised his head and looked around, but he could see no one. He lay still for a long time, his nerves on full alert, ready to flee or possibly make a desperate counterattack if the enemy came at him. The next crack was from farther away. Then silence. He knows I'm here. Has he taken up a position somewhere, waiting for me to start moving? Or has he retreated? Blomqvist kept crawling through the undergrowth until he reached the Östergården fence. This was the next critical moment. A path ran inside the fence. He lay stretched out on the ground, watching. The farmhouse was 400 yards down a gentle slope. To the right of the house he saw cows grazing. Why hadn't anyone heard the shots and come to investigate? Summer. Maybe nobody is at home right now. There was no question of crossing the pasture. There he would have no cover at all. The straight path beside the fence was the place he himself would have picked for a clear field of fire. He retreated into the brush until he came out on the other side, into a sparse pine wood. He took the long way around Östergården's fields and Söderberget to reach home. When he passed Östergården, he could see that their car was gone. At the top of Söderberget, he stopped and looked down on Hedeby. In the old fishing cabins by the marina, there were summer visitors. Women in bathing suits were sitting talking on a dock. He smelled something cooking on an outdoor grill. Children were splashing in the water near the docks in the marina. Just after 8. It was 50 minutes since the shots had been fired. Nielsen was watering his lawn, wearing shorts and no shirt. How long have you been there? Wanger's house was empty, but for Anna. Harold Wanger's house looked deserted as always. Then he saw Isabella Wanger in her back garden. She was sitting there, obviously, talking to someone. It took a second for Blomqvist to realize it was the sickly Gerda Wanger, born in 1922 and living with her son, Alexander, in one of the houses beyond Henrik's. He had never met her, but he had seen her a few times. Cecilia Wanger's house looked empty, but then Mikhail saw a movement in her kitchen. She's home. Was the marksman a woman? He knew that Cecilia could handle a gun. He could see Martin Wanger's car in the drive in front of his house. How long have you been home? Or was it someone else that he had not thought of yet? Frode? Alexander? Too many possibilities. He climbed down from Söderberget and followed the road into the village. He got home without encountering anyone. The first thing he saw was that the door of the cottage was ajar. He went into a crouch almost instinctively. Then he smelled coffee and saw Salander through the kitchen window. She heard him come in the front door and turned towards him. She stiffened. His face looked terrible, smeared with blood that had begun to congeal. The left side of his white T-shirt was crimson. He was holding a sodden red handkerchief to his head. "It's bleeding like hell, but it's not dangerous," Blomqvist said before she could ask.
She turned and got the first aid kit from the cupboard. It contained 2 packets of elastic bandages, a mosquito stick, and a little roll of surgical tape. He pulled off his clothes and dropped them on the floor, then he went to the bathroom. The wound on his temple was a gash so deep that he could lift up a big flap of flesh. It was still bleeding and it needed stitches, but he thought it would probably heal if he taped it closed. He ran a towel under the cold tap and wiped his face. He held the towel against his temple while he stood under the shower and closed his eyes. Then he slammed his fist against the tile so hard that he scraped his knuckles.
"Fuck you, whoever you are," he thought. "I'm going to find you, and I will get you."
When Salander touched his arm, he jumped as if he had had an electric shock and stared at her with such anger in his eyes that she took a step back. She handed him the soap and went back to the kitchen without a word. He put on 3 strips of surgical tape. He went into the bedroom, pulled on a clean pair of jeans and a new T-shirt, taking the folder of printed-out photographs with him. He was so furious, he was almost shaking.
"Stay here, Elizabeth," he shouted.
He walked over to Cecilia Wanger's house and rang the doorbell. It was 30 minutes before she opened the door.
"I don't want to see you," she said.
Then she saw his face, where blood was already seeping through the tape.
"Let me in. We have to talk."
She hesitated.
"We have nothing to talk about."
"We do now. And you can discuss it here on the steps or in the kitchen."
Blomqvist's tone was so determined that Cecilia stepped back and let him in. He sat at her kitchen table.
"What have you done?" she said.
"You claim that my digging for the truth about Harriet Wanger is some futile form of occupational therapy for Henrik. That's possible. But an hour ago someone bloody nearly shot my head off, and last night someone, maybe the same humorist, left a horribly dead cat on my porch."
Cecilia opened her mouth, but Blomqvist cut her off.
"Cecilia, I don't give a shit about your hang-ups or what you worry about or the fact that you suddenly hate the sight of me. I'll never come near you again, and you don't have to worry that I'm going to bother you or run after you. Right this minute I wish I'd never heard of you, or anyone else in the Wanger family, but I require answers to my questions. The sooner you answer them, the sooner you'll be rid of me."
"What do you want to know?"
"1, where were you an hour ago?"
Cecilia's face clouded over.
"An hour ago I was in Hedestad."
"Can anyone confirm where you were?"
"Not that I can think of, and I don't have to account to you."
"2, why did you open the window in Harriet's room the day she disappeared?"
"What?"
"You heard me. For all these years Henrik has tried to work out who opened the window in Harriet's room during those critical minutes. Everybody has denied doing it. Someone is lying."
"And what in hell makes you think it was me?"
"This picture," Blomqvist said, and flung the blurry photograph onto her kitchen table.
Cecilia walked over to the table and studied the picture. Blomqvist thought he could read shock on her face. She looked up at him. He felt a trickle of blood run down his cheek and drop onto his shirt.
"There were 60 people on the island that day," he said, "and 28 of them were women. 5 or 6 of them had shoulder-length blonde hair. Only one of those was wearing a light-coloured dress."
She stared intently at the photograph.
"And you think that's supposed to be me?"
"If it isn't you, I'd like you to tell me who you think it is."
"Nobody knew about this picture before.
I've had it for weeks and tried to talk to you about it. I may be an idiot, but I haven't showed it to Henrik or anyone else because I'm deathly afraid of casting suspicion on you or doing you wrong. But I do have to have an answer."
"You'll get your answer."
She held out the photograph to him.
"I didn't go into Harriet's room that day. It's not me in the picture. I didn't have the slightest thing to do with her disappearance."
She went to the front door.
"You have your answer. Now please go. But I think you should have a doctor look at that wound."
Salander drove him to Hedestad Hospital. It took only 2 stitches and a good dressing to close the wound. He was given cortisone salve for the rash from the stinging nettles on his neck and hands. After they left the hospital, Blomqvist sat for a long time, wondering whether he ought to go to the police. He could see the headlines now. "Libel journalist in shooting drama." He shook his head.
"Let's go home," he said.
It was dark when they arrived back at Hedeby Island, and that suited Salander fine. She lifted a sports bag onto the kitchen table.
"I borrowed this stuff from Milton Security, and it's time we made use of it."
She planted 4 battery-operated motion detectors around the house and explained that if anyone came closer than 20 feet, a radio signal would trigger a small chirping alarm that she set up in Blomqvist's bedroom. At the same time, 2 light-sensitive video cameras that she had put in trees at the front and back of the cabin would send signals to a PC laptop that she set in the cupboard by the front door. She camouflaged the cameras with dark cloth. She put a 3rd camera in a birdhouse above the door. She drilled a hole right through the wall for the cable. The lens was aimed at the road and the path from the gate to the front door. It took a low-resolution image every second and stored them all on the hard drive of another PC laptop in the wardrobe. Then she put a pressure-sensitive doormat in the entrance. If someone managed to evade the infrared detectors and got into the house, a 115-decibel siren would go off. Salander demonstrated for him how to shut off the detectors with a key to a box in the wardrobe. She had also borrowed a night-vision scope.
"You don't leave a lot to chance,"
Blomqvist said, pouring coffee for her.
"One more thing. No more jogging until we crack this."
"Believe me, I've lost all interest in exercise."
"I'm not joking. This may have started out as a historical mystery, but what with dead cats and people trying to blow your head off, we can be sure we're on somebody's trail."
They ate dinner late. Blomqvist was suddenly dead tired and had a splitting headache. He could hardly talk any more, so he went to bed. Salander stayed up reading the report until 2.
Chapter 23. Friday, July 11th. He awoke at 6, with the sun shining through a gap in the curtains right in his face. He had a vague headache, and it hurt when he touched the bandage. Salander was asleep on her stomach, with one arm flung over him. He looked down at the dragon on her shoulder blade. He counted her tattoos. As well as a wasp on her neck, she had a loop around one ankle, another loop around the biceps of her left arm, a Chinese symbol on her hip, and a rose on one calf. He got out of bed and pulled the curtains tight. He went to the bathroom and then padded back to bed, trying to get in without waking her. A couple of hours later, over breakfast, Blomqvist said,
"How are we going to solve this puzzle?"
"We sum up the facts we have. We try to find more."
"For me, the only question is, why? Is it because we're trying to solve the mystery about Harriet, or because we've uncovered a hitherto unknown serial killer?"
"There must be a connection," Salander said. "If Harriet realized that there was a serial killer, it can only have been someone she knew. If we look at the cast of characters in the 60s, there were at least 2 dozen possible candidates. Today, hardly any of them are left except Harold Wanger, who's not running around in the woods of Fruskogen at almost 93 with a gun. Everybody is either too old to be of any danger today, or too young to have been around in the 50s. So we're back to square one."
"Unless there are 2 people who are collaborating, one older and one younger."
"Harold and Cecilia? I don't think so. I think she was telling the truth when she said that she wasn't the person in the window."
"Then who was that?"
They turned on Blomqvist's iBook and spent the next hour studying in detail once again all the people visible in the photographs of the accident on the bridge.
"I can only assume that everyone in the village must have been down there watching all the excitement. It was September. Most of them are wearing jackets or sweaters. Only 1 person has long blonde hair and a light-coloured dress."
"Cecilia Wanger is in a lot of the pictures. She seems to be everywhere, between the buildings and the people who are looking at the accident. Here she's talking to Isabella. Here she's standing next to Pastor Falk. Here she's with Gregor Wanger, the middle brother."
"Wait a minute," Blomqvist said. "What does Gregor have in his hand?"
"Something square-shaped. It looks like a box of some kind."
"It's a Hasselblad."
"So he too had a camera." They scrolled through the photographs one more time. Gregor was in more of them, though often blurry. In one it could be clearly seen that he was holding a square-shaped box.
"I think you're right. It's definitely a camera."
"Which means that we go on another hunt for photographs."
"Okay, but let's leave that for a moment," Salander said. "Let me propose a theory."
"Go ahead."
"What if someone of the younger generation knows that someone of the older generation is a serial killer, but they don't want it acknowledged? The family's honour and all that crap. That would mean that there are 2 people involved, but not that they're in it together.
The murderer could have died years ago. Well, our nemesis just wants us to drop the whole thing and go home." "But why, in that case, put a mutilated cat on our porch? It's an unmistakable reference to the murders."
Blomqvist tapped Harriet's Bible.
"Again a parody of the laws regarding burnt offerings."
Salander leaned back and looked up at the church as she quoted from the Bible. It was as if she were talking to herself.
"Then he shall kill the bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall present the blood, and they shall throw the blood round about against the altar that is the door of the tent of meeting, and he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces."
She fell silent, aware that Blomqvist was watching her with a tense expression. He opened the Bible to the first chapter of Leviticus.
"Do you know verse 12, too?"
Salander did not reply.
"And he shall," he began, nodding at her.
"And he shall cut it into pieces, with its head and its fat, and the priest shall lay them in order upon the wood that is on the fire upon the altar."
Her voice was ice.
"And the next verse?"
Abruptly she stood up.
"Lisbeth, you have a photographic memory," Mikhail exclaimed in surprise. "That's why you can read a page of the investigation in 10 seconds.
Her reaction was almost explosive. She fixed her eyes on Blomqvist with such fury that he was astounded. Then her expression changed to despair, and she turned on her heel and ran for the gate.
"Lisbeth!"
he shouted after her. She disappeared up the road. Mikhail carried her computer inside, set the alarm, and locked the front door before he set out to look for her. He found her 20 minutes later on a jetty at the marina. She was sitting there dipping her feet in the water and smoking. She heard him coming along the jetty, and he saw her shoulders stiffen. He stopped a couple of paces away.
"I don't know what I did, but I didn't mean to upset you."
He sat down next to her, tentatively placing a hand on her shoulder.
"Please, Lisbeth, talk to me."
She turned her head and looked at him.
"There's nothing to talk about," she said.
"I'm just a freak, that's all." "I'd be overjoyed if my memory was what yours is."
She tossed the cigarette end into the water. Mikhail sat in silence for a long time.
"What am I supposed to say? You're a perfectly ordinary girl. What does it matter if you're a little different? What kind of self-image do you have anyway?"
"I thought there was something different about you the instant I saw you," he said.
"And you know what? It's been a really long time since I've had such a spontaneous good impression of anyone from the very beginning."
Some children came out of a cabin on the other side of the harbour and jumped into the water. The painter, Eugen Norman, with whom Blomqvist still had not exchanged a single word, was sitting in a chair outside his house, sucking on his pipe as he regarded Blomqvist and Salander.
"I really want to be your friend if you'll let me," he said. "But it's up to you. I'm going back to the house to put on some more coffee. Come home when you feel like it."
He got up and left her in peace. He was only halfway up the hill when he heard her footsteps behind him. They walked home together, without exchanging a word. She stopped him just as they reached the house.
"I was in the process of formulating a theory. We talked about the fact that all this is a parody of the Bible. It's true that he took a cat apart, but I suppose it will be hard to get hold of an ox. But he's following the basic story. I wonder..."
She looked up at the church again.
"And they shall throw the blood round about against the altar that is the door of the tent of meeting."
They walked over the bridge to the church. Blomqvist tried the door, but it was locked. They wandered around for a while, looking at headstones, until they came to the chapel, which stood a short distance away, down by the water. All of a sudden, Blomqvist opened his eyes wide. It was not a chapel. It was a crypt. Above the door he could read the name Wanger, chiseled into the stone, along with a verse in Latin, but he could not decipher it.
"Slumber to the end of time," Salander said behind him.
Blomqvist turned to look at her. She shrugged.
"I happened to see that verse somewhere."
Blomqvist roared with laughter. She stiffened, and at first she looked furious, but then she relaxed when she realized that he was laughing at the comedy of the situation. Blomqvist tried the door. It was locked. He thought for a moment, then told Salander to sit down and wait for him. He walked over to see Anna Nigren and knocked. He explained that he wanted to have a closer look at the family crypt, and he wondered where Henrik might keep the key. Anna looked doubtful, but she collected the key from his desk. As soon as they opened the door,
They knew that they had been right. The stench of burned cadaver and charred remains hung heavy in the air. But the cat torturer had not made a fire. In one corner stood a blowtorch, the kind used by skiers to melt the wax on their skis. Salander got the camera out of the pocket of her jeans skirt and took some pictures. Then, gingerly, she picked up the blowtorch.
"This could be evidence. He might have left fingerprints," she said.
"Oh, sure. We can ask the Vanger family to line up and give us their fingerprints," Blomqvist smiled. "I would love to watch you get Isabella's."
"There are ways," Salander said.
There was a great deal of blood on the floor, not all of it dry, as well as a bolt cutter, which they reckoned had been used to cut off the cat's head. Blomqvist looked around. A raised sarcophagus belonged to Alexander Vangirsad, and four graves in the floor housed the remains of the earliest family members. More recently, the Vangers had apparently settled for cremation. About 30 niches on the wall had the names of the clan ancestors. Blomqvist traced the family chronicle forward in time, wondering where they buried family members who were not given space inside the crypt. Those not deemed important enough. "Now we know," Blomqvist said, as they were recrossing the bridge. "We're hunting for the complete lunatic."
"What do you mean?"
Blomqvist paused in the middle of the bridge and leaned on the rail. "If this was some run-of-the-mill crackpot who was trying to frighten us, he would have taken the cat down to the garage, or even out into the woods. But he went to the crypt. There's something compulsive about that. Just think of the risk. It's summer and people are out and about at night, going for walks. The road through the cemetery is a main road between the north and south of Haderby. Even if he shut the door behind him, the cat must have raised Cain, and there must have been a burning smell."
"He?
I don't think that Cecilia Vanger would be creeping around here in the night with a blowtorch." Salander shrugged.
"I don't trust any last one of them, including Froda or your friend Henrik. They're all part of a family that would swindle you if they had the chance. So what do we do now?"
Blomqvist said, "I've discovered a lot of secrets about you. How many people, for example, know that you're a hacker?"
"No one."
"No one except me, you mean?"
"What are you getting at?"
"I want to know if you're okay with me. If you trust me." She looked at him for a long moment. Finally, for an answer, she only shrugged.
"There's nothing I can do about it."
"Do you trust me?" Blomqvist persisted.
"For the time being," she said.
"Good. Let's go over to see Froda." This was the first time Advocate Froda's wife had met Salander. She gave her a wide-eyed look at the same time as she smiled politely. Froda's face lit up when he saw Salander. He stood to welcome them.
"How nice to see you," he said. "I've been feeling guilty that I never properly expressed my gratitude for the extraordinary work you did for us, both last winter and now this summer."
Salander gave him a suspicious glare.
"I was paid," she said.
"That's not it. I made some assumptions about you when I first saw you. You would be kind to pardon me in retrospect."
Blomqvist was surprised. Froda was capable of asking a 25-year-old pierced and tattooed girl to forgive him for something for which he had no need to apologize. The lawyer climbed a few notches in Blomqvist's eyes. Salander stared straight ahead, ignoring him. Froda looked at Blomqvist.
"What did you do to your head?"
They sat down. Blomqvist summed up the developments of the past 24 hours. As he described how someone had shot at him out near the fortress, Froda leaped to his feet.
"This is barking mad."
He paused and fixed his eyes on Blomqvist.
"I'm sorry, but this has to stop. I can't have it. I'm going to talk to Henrik and break the contract." "Sit down," said Blomqvist. "You don't understand." "What I understand is that Lisbeth and I have got so close that whoever is behind all of this is reacting in a deranged manner, in panic. We've got some questions. First of all, how many keys are there to the Vanger family crypt and who has one?"
"It's not my province and I have no idea," Froda said. "I would suppose that several family members would have access to the crypt. I know that Henrik has a key, and that Isabella sometimes goes there, but I can't tell you whether she has her own key or whether she borrows Henrik's."
"Okay. You're still on the main board. Are there any corporate archives?
a library or something like that, where they've collected press clippings and information about the firm over the years.
Yes, there is, at the Hedestad main office.
We need access to it. Are there any old staff newsletters or anything like that?
Again, I have to concede that I don't know. I haven't been to the archives myself in 30 years. You need to talk to a woman named Bodil Lindgren.
Could you call her and arrange that Lisbeth has access to the archives this afternoon? She needs all the old press clippings about the Vanger Corporation.
That's no problem. Anything else?
Yes. Gregor Vanger was holding a Hasselblad in his hand on the day the bridge accident occurred. That means that he also might have taken some pictures. Where would the pictures have ended up after his death?
With his widow or his son, logically. Let me call Alexander and ask him.
What am I looking for?
Salander said when they were on their way back to the island.
Press clippings and staff newsletters. I want you to read through everything around the dates when the murders in the 50s and 60s were committed. Make a note of anything that strikes you.
Better if you do this part of the job. It seems that your memory... She punched him in the side. 5 minutes later, her Kawasaki was clattering across the bridge.
Blomqvist shook hands with Alexander Vanger. He had been away for most of the time that Blomqvist had been in Hedeby. He was 20 when Harriet disappeared.
Dirk said that you wanted to look at old photographs.
Your father had a Hasselblad, I believe.
That's right. It's still here, but no one uses it.
I expect you know that Henrik has asked me to study again what happened to Harriet.
That's what I understand. There are plenty of people who aren't happy about that.
Apparently so. And of course you don't have to show me anything.
Please. What would you like to see?
If your father took any pictures on the day of the accident, the day that Harriet disappeared. They went up to the attic. It took several minutes before Alexander was able to identify a box of unsorted photographs.
Take home the whole box, he said. If there are any at all, they'll be in there.
As illustrations for the family chronicle, Gregor Vanger's box held some real gems, including a number of Gregor together with Sven Olof Lindholm, the big Swedish Nazi leader in the 40s. Those he set aside. He found envelopes of pictures that Gregor had taken of family gatherings, as well as many typical holiday photographs, fishing in the mountains and a journey in Italy. He found 4 pictures of the bridge accident. In spite of his exceptional camera, Gregor was a wretched photographer. 2 pictures were close-ups of the tanker truck itself, 2 were of spectators taken from behind. He found only 1 in which Cecilia Vanger was visible in semi-profile. He scanned in the pictures, even though he knew that they would tell him nothing new. He put everything back in the box and had a sandwich lunch as he thought things over. Then he went to see Anna.
Do you think Henrik had any photograph albums other than the ones he assembled for his investigation about Harriet?
Yes, Henrik has always been interested in photography. Ever since he was young, I've been told, he has lots of albums in his office.
Could you show me?
Her reluctance was plain to see. It was one thing to lend Blomqvist the key to the family crypt. God was in charge there, after all. But it was another matter to let him into Henrik Vanger's office. God's writ did not extend there.
Blomqvist suggested that Anna should call Froda. Finally, she agreed to allow him in.
Almost 3 feet of the very bottom shelf was taken up with photograph albums. He sat at the desk and opened the first album. Vanger had saved every last family photograph. Many were obviously from long before his time. The oldest pictures dated back to the 1870s, showing gruff men and stern women. There were pictures of Vanger's parents. One showed his father celebrating midsummer with a large and cheerful group in Sandhamn in 1906. Another Sandhamn photograph showed Fredrik Vanger and his wife Ulrika, with Anders Zorn and Albert Engström sitting at a table. Other photographs showed workers on the factory floor and in offices. He found Captain Oscar Granath, who had transported Vanger and his beloved Edith Lobach to safety in Karlskrona. Anna came upstairs with a cup of coffee. He thanked her. By then he had reached modern times and was paging through images of Vanger in his prime, opening factories, shaking hands with Tage Erlander, one of Vanger and Marcus Wallenberg, the 2 capitalists staring grimly at each other. In the same album he found a spread on which Vanger had written in pencil,
Family Council, 1966. Two colour photographs showed men talking and smoking cigars. He recognised Henrik, Harald, Gregor, and several of the male in-laws in Johan Wanger's branch of the family. Two photographs showed the formal dinner, 40 men and women seated at the table all looking into the